I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is chef and author Joyce Goldstein. She's joined in conversation by food writer and restaurateur Patricia Unterman. And now, join Brian Garrick on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Joyce Goldstein and Patricia Unterman.
Baby vegetables, baby greens, goat cheese, pizza, salsa, fresh, organic, seasonal, local, pasture-raised, farm-to-table, ingredient-driven, live fire cooking, open kitchen, daily menu, fusion cuisine. These are the hallmarks of California cuisine, an approach to cooking, eating, and farming rooted in the geography and the people of this state. Nowadays, these values have become part of our national vocabulary, but this wasn't always the case. With her new book, Inside the California Food Revolution, 30 Years That Changed Our Culinary Consciousness, Joyce Goldstein has written the definitive history of how California has shaped our food culture. For decades, Joyce has been one of the most important people in the Bay Area culinary scene. For 12 years, she was chef and owner of the groundbreaking Mediterranean restaurant Square One here in San Francisco. Her menu presented the foods of Italy, Spain, France, Greece, Turkey, the Middle East, and North Africa. Prior to Square One, Joyce was the chef at the cafe at Chez Panisse for 3 years. She was the founder and director of the California Street Cooking School, San Francisco's first international cooking school, and has taught kitchen design for UC Berkeley's Department of Architecture. She received the James Beard Award for Best Chef in California for 1993, and in 2005 was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award from Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. Joyce is a prolific cookbook author. Her many books include Back to Square One, Old World Food, and A New World Kitchen, which won both the Julia Child and James Beard Awards for Best General Cookbook of 1992, and Festive Occasions with Chuck Williams, which received the 1993 James Beard Award for Best Entertaining Cookbook. She currently contributes the California Local column for the San Francisco Chronicle's Food and Wine section. And in conversation with Joyce tonight is the food critic and longtime owner of Hay Street Grill, Patty Unterman. So without further ado, please welcome Patty and Joyce to the stage.
Well, here we are, food lovers all. And Joyce, don't you think it's true we are living in a food paradise? I mean, what a great place we are. We travel all over, and there are very few locations anywhere in the world where we can eat and cook and shop so well with such satisfaction. And it wasn't always like that, was it?
No, it wasn't. I moved here in 1960, and there were supermarkets, but nothing like the specialty produce that we had now. There were very limited selection of cheeses. There were mostly European wines, surprisingly, in the stores. California wines hadn't gotten the attention yet. And, I mean, I was cooking all the time, but I had been living in Italy before I came here, and a lot of the ingredients that I had been used to cooking with were not available. So it was a very different world. I mean, we just didn't have the goods. And if you ate out, you ate in restaurants that were called continental or French or old-fashioned Italian, and the menu never changed. It was the same menu 365 days a year. So it was tomatoes, mozzarella, basil in December and July. I mean, it didn't matter. But people didn't mind as much because they didn't eat out that much. I mean, those were the years where people ate out for graduations, birthdays, anniversaries. It wasn't the eating out culture that we have now.
Well, so what do you think happened? What do you think happened in the 70s to cause this change in what people wanted?
Well, I think the first thing was that travel became reasonable. People could go to Europe. You remember the $5 a day program, which, $5 a minute now, but $5 a day. And people came back having dined out in a variety of different kinds of restaurants, trattorias, bistros, grand places, little intimate restaurants, and some of the fancier restaurants in France. And they came back and they thought, well, why can't we have this? Why can't we have this? And some of the people that were doing the traveling turned out to be some of our chefs. We had traveled too, and we kept saying, why can't we have this? Why can't we have that? So there was a different kind of exposure of what we wanted. Also, Julia Child's book came out at that time, Marcella's book. People started cooking food, watching television, this Galloping Gourmet and Julia. So there was an interest in cuisine that was starting to happen, which really hadn't been here before. And the new restaurants that opened, well, the French Laundry up in Napa when Sally Schmidt was there, and downstairs at Chez Panisse started to write a menu every day. And because they wanted to just cook with what was best that day. They didn't want to serve tomatoes, mozzarella, and basil in February. And there were restaurateurs that were upset when they heard this. They said, well, they're going to lose all their customers. But you see, once you train your customers that it's a new menu every day, they expect a new menu every day. They don't come in looking for their one favorite that they ate out once a year. They were more open to it. So there was a whole social change. People, women were working, so families ate out a lot more. And people ate out at business lunches, which we didn't have as much of before. So the whole demographic changed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ironic in a way that the California movement started through travel, through broader exposure of leaving California, going out and tasting something just so spectacular, and then figuring out, in a way, how to get it here. It's a very interesting irony. I mean, this book is really an amazing piece of work. I mean, it is so well researched. It's got just an enormous amount of material. Tell us, it really traces 30 years of a food movement and a very important and complicated one. I mean, in all its facets. First of all, what was your methodology? How did you gather this stuff?
This is an interesting story. Obviously, I've written 26 cookbooks, and writing a cookbook is an easy thing to do because you've got poultry and fish and soups and whatever, and you write a recipe and you test it, and it comes out, and you keep refining the way you write it and make it sound sexy so people want to do it. This is a history. I'd never written a history before in my life. And University of California Press came to me, and Dara Goldstein was heading up this program of all the history of California food and wine. And they said, we think you should be the one to write this history of California cuisine. And I thought, oh my God, can I do this? Because it was not anything I had done before. But after a while, I realized I could do it because I had been here since 1960. I knew chefs north and south. I knew purveyors. I knew artisans. I knew food writers. And I figured if I called them up, they would take my call. So I set out to interview. I had a list of people. And I sent it to a whole bunch of people and called them and emailed. And then I said, if there's any names missing from this list of people you think I should talk to, please let me know. I don't want to miss anyone important. And then I set about doing the interviews, which took about 9 months, just tracking people down and getting and setting up the time, and then listening to the interviews and then getting them transcribed. And here, I have to say, my granddaughter, Elena, did about 70% of the transcriptions and became a California cuisine fanatic. She would stop chefs at the farmer's market and say, I just transcribed her interview. And then I had to find other people to do the other ones. And then I was left with this just mountain of material. And I had written a table of contents that we had all agreed on. And they sent me at one point to a special editor because they wanted to make sure that I knew how to write a history and have chronology right. But it lost something in translation. It came out a little dry, a little academic. It didn't sound like me either. And fortunately, Dory Brown at the press said, we got to put your voice back in here. And she stepped in and really guided me in the most beautiful way to do this book. We had a wonderful dialogue going back and forth. And she asked a lot of questions, so that made me explain things more carefully. You know, when you're in the business, you take a lot of things for granted. Yeah. But then to have someone ask you, well, what does that mean, you know, when you have a bigger pantry station? Or what does that mean? You had to really think it through and explain it. So I then handed in a manuscript that was way too long. Because when you've interviewed all these people, you want to include them. And you can't include everybody. And sometimes you read the quotes, and some people said it better than other people. So for the people that I interviewed that didn't appear, I feel really bad, because their information was also valuable to me. And then I had quotes that were too long, so again, Dory helped me shrink them so that we could come in with a book that wasn't a doorstop that people would read.
One thing that I liked is sort of in these chapters are little stories directly about the chefs
the
and
profiles.
The different producers, different people, sort of inserts that give a whole little history and background that I think was a very nice way to handle it, because there are so many different and diverse people that have contributed to this. And so in the story, in this whole 30-year story, there are these little sections that talk about individuals, and I thought that worked really well.
Everybody's story was so interesting,
and
they were so open, too, because I think they realized this was an important point. After all the work that we did, that finally someone would hear their story and hear about their work. I mean, like George Ann Brennan. Now, I've known George Ann for years as an author of cookbooks, but she was our Johnny Appleseed. She brought in all the seeds that the chefs wanted, all the seeds for the produce that we wanted. And then a lot of them were so new, she went out into the fields with the farmers to show them how to grow the food. And, you know, we should send her a thank you note all the time. I mean, without her, there'd be no lacinato kale, there'd be no radicchio, no chioggia beets. I mean, a lot of the things that we just take for granted. And then people like Bruce Lefevre, who wanted arugula, and Alice, who wanted arugula, and there were two people growing it. Warren Weber and Forney Brown were growing it. And they didn't even know what to charge for it. And Bruce Lefevre said, well, when I was buying it in Europe, this much was about the price of a pack of cigarettes. And so they priced it according to a pack of cigarettes. I mean, there was no context for it. So everybody had these funny little contributions that, you know, most kids working in the restaurant business today, you say the names of some of these people, they go, huh, who, what? Because for them, it's what's now and what's on TV. And a lot of the people that did amazing work, I wanted them to know who these people were, because you just, without them, they wouldn't be able to cook what they're cooking or do what they do.
So. Yeah, I particularly like the stories about the chicken producers and the beef producers, the animal husbandry people. I mean, you never think about that when you get this beautiful stuff, and it's hard work.
It's very hard work.
Yeah.
And the thing that was also so amazing is that just like many of the chefs were self-taught, but many of the artisans were self-taught.
Exactly.
Bill Nyman was learning by trial and error and asking people around him. When you think Philip Payne with his squab, he talked to people that had been raising birds for years but hadn't really done any crossbreeding. Jim Reichert's family had been growing the ducks for Chinatown, but when Barbara Trop told him that we need ducks with more meat on them, he set about to breed a different kind of duck, and he just also trial and error. Laura Chanel taught herself how to make cheese. I mean, you know, now these are all people with successful businesses, but they didn't go to school to do it. Steve Sullivan learned how to make bread in his dormitory, and then he got a chance to practice at Chez Panisse. But these were people that were all crazy, driven people. Once they got their minds on something that they wanted to do, nothing stopped them. They just kept going until they got it right.
Well, so you had a little of that bug yourself, didn't you?
I had the bug.
I mean, what was it? I know for me, it was, I'd been through, you know, graduate school in journalism, and then all I wanted to do was open a little restaurant. Something just took over.
I think it was a time where, having traveled and eaten well, we wanted to share this feeding of people and the pleasure that we had gotten. You wanted to share the pleasure. I don't think any of us that went into the restaurant business in the 70s and 80s ever thought we'd make a nickel. We didn't do it for money. We certainly didn't think we were going to be famous, because there was just no such thing. We did it to cook for people. I love cooking for people. I mean, I'm sort of shocked that I ended up in the restaurant business, because as a child I was the problem eater, and and I didn't like the food at home. I did eat out well in restaurants, I must say. I discovered there was good food. But, you know, I think if my family, who are all gone now, were to realize that I had been in the restaurant business, they would just pass out. They wouldn't believe it for a minute. But I loved cooking for people. There's just nothing better than having someone come up and say, oh, that was the best pasta I had, or, oh, it reminds me of my grandmother, or whatever it was. Well, it just made your day, kept you going. But cooking was so important.
Well, so this is something that you discuss in your book quite a bit. I mean, do you think that that's a woman's thing, or...
Well, we had male chefs who were also self-taught. No, I think what happens is that some of it kicks in from food of memory. You ate some things that were wonderful, and you wanted to taste them again. And if you didn't go to cooking school or work in the trade, you had to figure it out for yourself. Maybe you started with a cookbook. But I think of Mourad, who came here as a graduate student from Morocco, and he's missing his family. He's a little homesick. He misses the food. He starts experimenting at home. He and his brother open this restaurant in Marin with no restaurant experience, not even a menu. They just said, tell him to give us $40 and we'll cook for them. He didn't even remember what he made for one table for the other table. But the food was really good. And over time, he realized, I'm not going back to graduate school. I'm going to cook. So he's self-taught. Hasare is self-taught. There are lots of Charles Fan, self-taught. My fam also. I mean, a lot of us just, we wanted to cook. Cooking was important, and we didn't mind how many times we tried something until we got it right. But there's this thing about wanting to recreate flavors and share them with people. I mean, we did have people here who went to culinary school. A lot of the French guys that came here, Roland and Gérald, they had all been to school and in proper training programs. And that was one approach. But the restaurants that were among the most successful were the ones where people were self-taught. And, I mean, you think of stars. Jeremiah never went to culinary school. Chez Panisse, Alice never went to culinary school. Square One, I never went to school. And I'm thinking of all the other people that were just cooking because we knew we could do it, and the Bay Area was such a permissive community that they supported you. Mm-hmm. They didn't walk around and say, what are your credentials? You know, have you been on TV? What school did you go to? Nobody cared. So as long as the food was good and they were having a good time, everybody did well.
Yeah, there was a lot of hunger there. People were hungry. They wanted to eat the kind of food that they imagined, that they'd always sort of hoped to have, maybe from traveling or whatnot.
You're listening to chef and author Joyce Goldstein, whose latest book is Inside the California Food Revolution, 30 Years That Changed Our Culinary Consciousness. She's joined in conversation by Patricia Unterman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But it always interests me, the motivation of so many chefs to cook to please, you know, that even the trained chefs, I think, the most trained chefs, when you end up eating with them, they want to give pleasure. They want to, pleasure is really the principle, and San Francisco is a town that I think loves its pleasures.
We are, you know, the hedonists. We definitely are. No, I mean, actually, some of the major industries of the Bay Area are connected to food and wine. It sort of drives our community. We are food obsessed. I mean, there's an anecdote in the book that I'll tell is really funny. I was driving up to Napa, go to the CIA, and I'm listening to an interview. Lemony Snicket is interviewing Sarah Vowell. And she lived here, and he asked her, well, why didn't she stay? And she said, I want to eat goat cheese, but I don't want to have to talk about it. And I howled when I heard this, because we talk about food all the time. You can be anywhere. You can be in the hair salon, and the people in the chair next to you are talking about where they ate yesterday and where they're going and who did they go to the market. You can be in the market, and people will see what's in your cart and what are you going to do with it. People talk about food and dining out and wine, and it definitely keeps us going. Southern California is not as crazy as we are. They're a different community. And I think they came to the food revolution in some ways later. In certain ways, as far as design and pizzazz and plating and social things, they were maybe a little ahead of us. I mean, I think of Michael McCarty opening Michael's and, you know, the waiters in pink shirts and chinos and tables and being outside. And it was a very L.A. kind of place. And they had never seen that before because they had those old dark continental creepy Hollywood restaurants, you know. And this was like a revolution. And Bruce Martyr out at the beach with West Beach Cafe, they were pioneers of a different style. And but they didn't become food crazy. They were more about being in a fun place next to celebrities, dramatic plating, everything being cool. Much bolder architectural statements. I think they were more adventurous than we were. But up here, it was, where did this come from? Who grew it? Where did the fish, how was it caught? We wanted to know all this. And when I mentioned this to some LA chefs, they said, what do? Get their phone number? I said, yes, sometimes we do get their phone number and call them up because we want to know. But I think the other irony is that their farmers market, the Santa Monica market, opened way before ours, but ours, the chefs were shopping there and telling the farmers what we wanted, whereas in L.A., the farmers were there, and chefs didn't start shopping there until 93, when Nancy Silverton started going there for Campanile. The chefs were totally removed from it. They were still dealing with the normal old distribution systems. So two different personalities down there.
Yeah, well, two different ways of life. I mean, if your business is entertainment and appearance and whatnot, then
you're in LA.
Yeah, it's very important. You talked in the book a lot about the way restaurants were set up, you know, with open kitchens and that
back and
forth kind of thing. And of course, now whenever anyone is remodeling their own home or whatever and likes to cook, that same model, they're doing that same kind of design. I mean, talk a little bit about that.
I think, well, actually, the open kitchen, you know, you were here a long time, and we had Vanessi's that had an open kitchen, but you never related to it quite the same way as you did the open kitchen at Square One or at Chez Panisse or at Spago. I mean, there the chefs were on stage and they were celebrity chefs. You knew them by name, whereas at places like Vanessi's or Tatish's, you didn't know who these people were cooking. They were just sort of cooks cooking. And you saw, you know, you could see the flames for a minute or whatever, but it wasn't the same thing. And the open kitchen was a revolution because all of a sudden, people would come up and talk to the cooks. And the cooks could see people eating the food that they cooked, and they could see them enjoying it and smiling, and people would come up and say, thank you, that was delicious. Well, that changed everything, too. And also, when you put a kitchen in a dining room, the whole demeanor of the room changes. The old continental restaurants, you came in, it was carpeted, there were booths, there were sconces, you whispered, waiter came over. You know, all of a sudden you're in a room, there's action happening, the whole room changes. And the people training, the servers, front of the house, realize that it still had to be impeccably professional, but it was a different, it was a more casual kind of thing. And it was also somehow more democratic. I think the old-fashioned restaurants, you had to be fairly well-to-do to go out. And here, we had so many price points and so many kinds of restaurants that, you know, I'd see a guy walk in a three-piece suit, and then I'd see a guy in flip-flops and shorts. And partly I'd go, oh my God, flip-flops and shorts. But the guy with the flip-flops and shorts bought the $150 bottle of wine, and the other guy bought a $5 glass or something. So you could not tell who was who. But you eventually found out who the food and wine fanatics were, because they kept coming back. And they knew your waiters, and they knew some of the cooks, and they'd read the menu, and they'd talk to you about the food. And also in the old days, with the menus never changing, the waiters were like robots. They'd have to learn one daily special, and that was it. Now, all of a sudden, our waiters had to taste everything because the menu changed all the time. They had to taste the wines by the glass because they were changed to go with the food. The waiters had to know where the fish came from, what farm, what butcher. They had to become trained. They became as knowledgeable often as the chefs because they had to give the information. And the diners up here were also so well informed that it was like belonging to a club of food fanatics. It really was. And everybody said, oh, yeah, I had that cheese the other day. Where can I get it? You know, I think people wanted also to be able to reproduce some of this food at home. And that's where the farmers markets came in and the support of all of our artisans.
Well, the irony is that with the open kitchen in the restaurant, There is actually less spontaneity, less, you know, the kitchen is on display, the cooks are cooking, they really have to get everything together. It's really a different experience than cooking behind a closed door where, you know,
pans are thrown, people are cursing,
or you can make a little change.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an odd.
I think it's an interesting thing. I think there, what it does, it means number one that the cooks can't touch their hair, or they can't stick their finger in and taste the sauce, because you are on stage. But it does mean that the kitchens are cleaner than ever before because they're in view. It means that there's a certain level of discipline, but line cooks can make an adjustment on a recipe. If you have a customer who says, blah, 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 could I do this? Most of the time, a change can be made. The days of people being rigid, this is mine, this is the way I do it, this is it, we won't change it, that's sort of going by the board. I mean, every once in a while there's somebody like that, some egomaniac who thinks that's perfect. But I think people wanted people to be happy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that in terms of this jump from the restaurant to lifestyle here, I mean, I think people, when they cook at home now, what maybe was done behind closed doors now becomes a participatory event. People are help. You invite people over, and they say, "What can I do? Can I help?" You know, and that whole thing, I think, is really nice, you know?
I think it's good, and I think it made cooking a lot more approachable. Unfortunately, I mean, what's happened with the television thing is it's made it approachable in the wrong way, because it's not like real life, and people see it and they think it's glamorous and it's exciting and everybody's a superstar. And you get a lot of young people going into the business that think it's going to be like TV, and then they have to clean 10 pounds of shrimp and they find, oh, it's not like TV. I don't have someone doing that. I got to do it. But I think it gave cooks a sense of self-respect, which I don't think they had before. And I think that's very important, because when you cook, first of all, it's really hard work to be a line cook. And the hours are long and the pay is not very high. And to be appreciated and to feel good about what you're doing is very important. I mean, the fact that even the chef's uniforms change. It was sort of a look at me. I don't have to wear a toque. I can wear a baseball cap or a beret. I've got on these fancy chef's pants. And people are enjoying it, and they're coming up, and they're watching what I'm doing at the grill, and they ask for advice for when they cook at home. I mean, there's something very beautiful about that. There isn't this distance and snobbishness about it, which I think has been a very good thing.
Well, what about the daily menu? You know, I think that maybe the biggest factor in that was the invention of the photocopying machine.
No, absolutely.
I remember when we opened Hay Street in 1979, we had a printed menu, and then we had a blackboard that where we put the fish on, and that the huge revolution came when the restaurant could actually photocopy a menu.
Oh, absolutely.
When was that? In the 80s?
Or? Well, that was in the 80s, and it was called desktop publishing. You could publish your own menu. You didn't have to send people out to a copy service or get a printed menu. And I liken it to, you know, in the old days, when menu never changed, it was a book, and then it started changing four times a year. It was maybe a magazine, and now it became a newspaper. And what I loved about it also is that it reflected what you had that day. You posted it outside. People could see what was coming on. And then if you started to run out of things, there was many a night when I went in and retyped the menu and put on another item so that they wouldn't yell at my waiter and say that was the one thing I wanted. So no one ever knew that you ran out because you just restuffed the menus. And I think it made people feel that everything was very fresh. And those, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but in the 70s at one point, the menus got so long, veal 42 different ways, you know, chicken this way. And now the menus were shorter because you knew the stuff just came in, it was fresh, this is what they had the time to prepare, and this was today's menu. And if you came tomorrow, there might be a couple things that repeated, but a lot of new things would be on because of what came in. I mean, you deal with Monterey fish every day, and I remember interviewing Paul and Tom, and, you know, in the old days, maybe the selection of fish was smaller. Now, the selection of fish is immense. And, you know, I remember calling at 7 in the morning, what's good? Now they send you a printout telling you who the fisherman was and how it was caught and where it was from. And it's been an education. That's the other thing about California that's amazing. If you were a chef on the East Coast and somebody asked where you were getting your lamb or your, you wouldn't tell them because it was competition. Here, if you ask somebody, they would give you the phone number. There was education and sharing of information and a really supportive community. I mean, we wanted those farmers to stay in business. We did not want them to go out. We wanted those artisans to stay in business. We wanted to send them as much business as possible so that we all could benefit from it. That's a very California thing to do, very Northern California thing to do.
That's true. So we have California cuisine changed the way we design our kitchens, the way menus were written and are written and put together. Let's see, what other?
Well, also we had a real change in the layout of the kitchen. And I think this is something that, unless you work in a restaurant, you're not aware of this. But in the classic European kitchen, there are flat tops and burners, but there weren't grills. And there was no live fire cooking unless it was a restaurant in the country. And the pantry station was very small. It put out tarts and pâté and a mixed green salad, and so that was a tiny station. Well, when you think of the California kitchen now, the pantry station is a big station because there are assortments of antipasti, charcuterie, mezza, all sorts of small plates, salads that have hot items added to them. It's got to be near the line. That whole station, which used to be just, you know, you'd put the beginning chef there because all I had to do was toss a salad with a dressing, slap a piece of tart on a plate, put some whipped cream, and that was that. They didn't have to know anything. Now they have to know how to cook. And so that station has become a very difficult station. You have to learn a lot. You get hit by every single customer. The other one, somebody gets from the grill, somebody from sauté, but that pantry person's really got to be on it. And so that changed. And then all the live fire cooking in California, the wood-burning ovens, both for pizza and for cooking of food, the wood-fired grills. I remember when Mesquite first came out, what a big deal that was, and how the hoods had to be recalibrated because they weren't ready for the huge heat generated by this and fire alarms going off and all this stuff.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that San Francisco had a long tradition of mesquite grilling at Tadich's, for example. Yeah. And so, I mean, a lot of these things were here in a way, but in a
But nobody noticed in a way because it was a different era where cooking was not as important. And, I mean, I know when Jeremiah did a lunch out in Rhode Island at some fancy big house, and it was for all the food writers, and he was supposed to be there and a French chef. Well, the French chef, of course, was given the kitchen, and Jeremiah and his gang were told that they could cope, and they set up these long grills, and they grilled their entire meal, and it got written up as California cuisine of grilling everything. Yeah, we had mesquite, but Texas had mesquite. I mean, everybody, it just that I think we didn't have as many grills as we had, and the grill became the focal point. You walked in, I mean, people would stand and watch food coming off the grill like they had never seen a barbecue before. They would just stand there, transfixed, and some of them were big. I think the one at Santa Fe Bar and Grill was like 7 feet tall. Yeah. They just opened a whole bag of mesquite, threw the whole thing on, set fire to it, and they'd be going for the day. So it was a big deal.
Yeah, it was. We were talking about this food of memory versus food of dreams, this kind of thing. I mean, I
was trying to get a way to explain the different kinds of cooking and the different kinds of cooks. And food of memory is a more traditional kind of cooking. It doesn't mean it doesn't have good technique. It has technique. But what's important is that you've tasted it and you're trying to recreate a flavor that you've had and you're aiming for it. You've got something that you're aiming for. It was a memorable meal or a memorable dish. And a lot of people who cook traditional food, family food, women, are cooking this kind of food. The other food is, what would happen if I did this? I've never put these six ingredients together. Let's see what would happen. That's food of dreams. Sometimes it works. Sometimes, as we saw in the 90s with all the fusion stuff, it can be a train wreck of just too many ingredients thrown together. And so it's a balance between the two. And I think the traditional food is one that lasts longer because people remember it. It's in the pipeline. Whereas the other food, it's here, it's gone. It's here, it's gone. Because newness and novelty is important. And I remember Bruce Hill telling me that once Mark France made something up at Starz, and Bruce loved it, and he was coming in for dinner, and he wanted to have it. And they were offended because they didn't want to do something that they had done before. And, you know, we don't think that way all the time anymore. I think the thing is, if something is good, you do want it to come back, and you do want it to become part of somebody else's food of memory. Let them remember it. because that's the food that you crave. That's why we have Thanksgiving and Hanukkah and all these things where there are certain iconic dishes that get prepared, maybe just once a year, but people look forward to them because it's a touchstone. And I think that has power and it has a story.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features chef and author Joyce Goldstein, whose latest book is Inside the California Food Revolution, 30 Years That Changed Our Culinary Consciousness. She's joined in conversation by Patricia Unterman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
That food that's just sort of flashy and I'm making it up and I'm having a good time and now I couldn't do it again tomorrow because I don't remember really what I did. That's another kind of cooking and it's sort of razzle-dazzle. And I don't know. I don't think it has the staying power.
Well, do you think that that's, as you put it, dude food, you know?
Well, a lot of it is dude food. I mean, we're having, I don't know how many of you have been following this whole thing with Time Magazine and the gods of food who all happen to be men and no women chefs. And I write about boy food and girl food in this book because it is an issue. And I think the thing is that there are many men who cook what I call girl food. I mean, you go to Delfina, they're cooking traditional food. Craig likes to tease me that he cooks like a girl. And Lawrence likes to tease me at NOPA that he cooks like a girl. But they're cooking traditional food based on, you know, cultural traditions of other countries or American food, but recognizable food. They're not deconstructing. They're not taking spaghetti carbonara and putting a stick of bacon and a wing of noodles and an egg yolk and a shard of Parmesan and calling it carbonara. It's something, but it's not that. They don't feel the need to break up clam chowder the way Jose Andres does, you know, where it's a potato foam and a frozen clam and whatever. I think it's fun. It's fun if you want to do it, but I think I'd rather eat clam chowder or carbonara. However, you don't want to stop people from experimenting or trying new things. You don't want to be the old, I'm the old fart, so you don't want to be the old fart that says, why are you doing that, you know, because it's got to taste good. The bottom line is, does it taste good? Or is it just interesting? Interesting is fine. You know how when you had something that you didn't like and people ask you how it was in their restaurant, you say it was interesting? It was interesting. But was it delicious? And I think that women also don't get the amount of press that the men do because they are the ones that need greater control of their time. They have family obligations. They work all day long. They don't go out cavorting with the boys, visiting other chefs and getting drunk at night because they're going to go home. And they don't feel the need to open 25 restaurants and piss on every hydrant in town. They stay in their place of business. They work. They know their customers. It's a different mindset. And so the fact that all these women were ignored by the idiot who edited the magazine caused a great groundswell, actually, sort of wonderful one. Because when I started thinking about goddesses of food and women of food, I think all the good editors at the cookbooks places have been women. The food editors at newspapers have been women. The people teaching, very often, are women. There are women now sommeliers all over the place. And yet if you went to that stupid movie, Somme, the women got 2 minutes and the men got the rest of the movie. That one made me really upset, all right, because there were more women sommeliers than ever before. And there were women making wine and women making cheese and women doing all sorts of things. But because it was posed, women chefs, no, we're not second-class citizens, but the press always likes to write up the guys because they're a little more outrageous. Women tend not to be outrageous. We're not outrageous enough. We need to learn to be outrageous. We do. We're too nice. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Many people have said to me, oh, well, I don't want to go out and eat something I could make at home. You know, I want something that's complicated or you know.
Well, that's why God made French restaurants. That's perfect.
Well, not the
no, but
country.
You know, I mean, if you want something really complicated with many steps, the thing is, if something is delicious, you're going to be happy that you ate it. Maybe it's complicated. Maybe it's simple. Maybe the ingredients are so good and they were handled so subtly that you might have overcooked it at home or done too much to it. So the bottom line is, what did they do with it and how did you like it? Can you still taste it? Can you remember it 2 days later? That's my test. Sometimes I go to these things and there are like 15 courses and the next day, I don't even remember what the hell I ate.
Yeah.
And it was sort of entertaining. So I guess I look for a taste that I remember. And that if I close my eyes, I can taste it again. That to me is a successful dish. And I don't care if there were 40 techniques used or two, as long as what I got was a memorable, delicious dish.
But, you know, there's been all this brouhaha about David Chang, this guy in New York who has Momofuku and some other places and who criticizes San Francisco for, you know, finding a perfect fig and putting it on a plate. He says, well, that's not cooking, that's shopping, right?
I used to say that to Alice, but that to me is... You've heard of Freud and penis envy. This is produce envy, is what it is. They cannot get those figs. And if they have to get those figs, they have to get them from California. So, of course, I mean, Rick Bayless was just here saying...
Yeah, can you believe that?
I could not believe it. And I actually wrote something in the paper about it because it was infuriating. Everybody's cooking seasonal food. Well, yes, we are. Why not? That's when the food is at its best and the price is right. And they're all cooking... pasta and pizza, and then he ate at Aziza, he ate at My China, he ate at all these places that didn't have pasta and pizza, and I'm thinking, what happened to you? Where were you? I mean, this is a man who has a huge garden behind his house. I've been there when he's harvesting zucchini blossoms to bring into his restaurant, and he's ragging on us for cooking seasonal food. I wanted to smack him, really.
Well, I guess his point was is that it all tasted the same to him.
He said they were all the same farms, and I wanted to say, yes, many of us are using the same farms because we want those farmers to be in business. We don't want them to have to let their workers go in the winter. We want them to have health insurance. We want them to be able to have a sustainable business. So, yes. I don't care how many people have Maraquita Farm on their menu. May everybody have it. I want Andy to stay in business. I want Warren Weber to stay in business. If everybody has Starwood Farm lettuce, it's good lettuce. That's fine. I think the thing is to be weird or to be different just for the sake of being different. I mean, yeah, there are people raising unusual little greens, and you can get microgreens flown in, all those little things. That's fine. That's very nice. But, you know, you want... to support the farms. I mean, real estate, land is expensive in California. And there are young people starting out now with small farms. I admire them so much. I want them to stay in business. I want to send them business. I want to find out what they're growing and get them networking so that they didn't pay all this money for land that they're leasing and then they go out of business. We're all in it together, you know. We got to take care of everybody.
You know, that really was the motivation for starting that when Sabella Krause started the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market. Her whole idea was to put together farmers and restaurant people, cooks, because it was the restaurant cooks that would be able to really buy enough to sustain
the
farmers.
Right.
And that was the brilliance of that market is that they always made it very easy for farmers and restaurant people to connect, and that was the brilliance of that thing.
Well, she was amazing. Sabella went out to all these farms to see what they were growing, and then she had to set up a system to get the stuff delivered to restaurants, and then the whole farmers market program that they put together was inspiring because she knew the chefs would follow through. You went to the tasting of summer produce. I don't know how many of you went to this, but there was a phenomenal one in Oakland on the steps of the Oakland Museum. For the first time, chefs, farmers, people in the press, everybody could go, and they had melon tastings. You could taste 15 different kinds of melons and 30 kinds of tomatoes and all these different peaches. People didn't even know this stuff existed. And now when you go to the market, you go from stall to stall and you'll taste, whose peaches were better today? Wait, I was over there. Now I'm going to go over there. I used to go with my grandkids. I said, go taste all these peaches and tell me which ones you like the best for me to buy. Because we have such variety and abundance in New York. I mean, you go to the Green Market, which has improved a lot. But at one point, there were only two people selling peaches. Here we have 12 people, 14 people selling peaches. I mean, sometimes we have too many choices. You can't make up your mind. But this is a very important thing, that we have so many people being able to express themselves and bring in this produce for us to cook with.
And that there's a connection between the growers and the
And the people urban shopping at the market. I hear people having conversations with the farmers all the time.
I know. Well, I think have we covered it?
We've certainly covered a lot. I'm sure there are people here that have some questions of us.
I know the book ends in 2000, but I know you're very involved in visiting lots of restaurants. You know lots of chefs. You really have your finger on the pulse. If you had to sum up what the most important developments since 2000 are in California cuisine, what are the things that really strike you?
Well, I think a greater dedication to sustainability and the environment. I think that we're going to see more of that. Less pomp and circumstance as far as grand fine dining and expensive. You're going to see more lower priced items that are more affordable, which I think is a very positive trend, so that more people can afford to eat out and don't have to be standing in the street at a truck when they might want to sit down and eat at some place that they could afford. I think you're going to see more places with more handcrafted food. Like the other day, they reviewed a restaurant that also now has a grocery where they're making a lot of preserves and things that will be supplying their restaurant. So that sort of customizing, I think, will, especially in Northern California, because that's who we are. There are other things that are just hard to predict. Is it going to be a triumph of technology over flavor? I don't know. They just had a conference up at the CIA on millennial appetites and molecular. And I thought, oh my God, all right. Well, the millennials, you know, they're into something one day, and then the next thing comes, they're into it the next day. So I wasn't really concerned about them terribly much. Although if I had a restaurant, I might be concerned with what they're eating now, the millennials. It didn't interest me. And I think this tension between technique and feeling, that's what I want to call it, soul, is going to be with us for a while, because the press is obsessed with reporting on it, and the boy chefs are interested in mastering as many techniques as possible, and it's going to keep getting attention. So that, I think we're going to still see more of that, and then maybe it'll settle down and it won't be in the foreground. One of the things that I think is sort of interesting is for a while we had a new kind of fusion happening, starting pretty much in L.A., with a lot of Asian kids eating a lot of Latino food. And Roy Choi, who had the Kogi food truck, who has a book coming out in a week or so, which is terrific, by the way, highly recommended, he realized that he came from fine dining, went to the CIA. He was a Korean kid, grew up in a Korean neighborhood, but been eating Latino food all of his life. And he started putting Korean flavors into tacos and quesadillas. Delicious, too, by the way. Really good, because he's got a really good palate. And then there were other people doing it. So it's a different kind of fusion than the fusion we had in the 90s, where people were just sort of picking an ingredient, ginger. Oh, I think I'll put it in osobuco, or I'll try, you know, something. I mean, no, we had people doing all sorts of, there was a risotto with blueberries and goat cheese and something, I don't remember. But there were a lot of very funny things of people taking things from different cultures and just sort of applying them like Band-Aids. But now we're having a more organic thing as people, these young people have eaten out a lot. You see, my generation, you ate out four times a year. This generation eats out all the time. So they've absorbed a different knowledge of food and a different sense of crossing of ethnic boundaries, some of which is going to be wonderful, some of it is going to be too many ingredients and probably won't survive. We're seeing a lot more of it in LA. We're going to see a lot of it trickling up here, and it's certainly happening across the country. As the information gets tweeted across, everybody will start doing it. I'm sure there are Korean tacos in New York right now. But occasionally, it's just a beautiful fusion because it's really understood viscerally and it's part of someone's culture. And that's the difference between soul cooking and just taking an idea because why not? I'll try a new technique and put a foam and then freeze it and it'll be there and deconstructed. That's another kind of why not. It's going to be interesting to see which of these trends has legs. But I think you're going to see a lot more cross-cultural stuff because one of the things that California did is it gave ethnic food a sense of dignity that it had not had before. In this country, French food was considered the grand food. Even Italian was considered ethnic. I mean, it was pizza and pasta and red sauce. It wasn't alta cucina or any of the fine dining Italian that you know today. Everything else was sort of, yes, there's French food, and then there's the rest of it. And a lot of restaurants here, Border Grill, well, Mary Sue and Susan at City started putting on French food, but then Thai and then Indian, but serving it in an upscale restaurant. Square One, we had Turkish, we had Greek, we had French, we had Italian, but all these ethnic flavors were in an upscale restaurant, which gave this food a little bit more respect and gravitas. And I think Barbara Tropp, with her restaurant, instead of using canned ingredients, she was getting the best ingredients for her Chinese food. Charles Fan, shopping very carefully for his ingredients. So these cuisines that you used to think were cheap and you should pay $3, and now they've been elevated because of the use of good ingredients and skillful cooking. And I think this is a very positive thing because people who come from ethnic minorities, soon to be majorities, in this, certainly in California, have a different sense of respect for their food. And it's treated differently. And I think we're learning a lot about other cultures in a form that we are willing to take it in, which is food. We're willing to learn it that way. It's sort of an interesting change.
Okay. Joyce Goldstein, Patty Unterman, audience, thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was chef and author Joyce Goldstein, whose latest book is Inside the California Food Revolution, 30 Years That Changed Our Culinary Consciousness. She's joined in conversation by Patricia Unterman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature novelist Meg Wolitzer. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.